choosing everything from the furniture to the colour of the walls. I always look for the most important details. The cracked mirror, the bloody fingerprint on the windowsill, anything that's important to the story. But they may not be there yet. It depends which way the camera is pointing. I often worry that the room will seem far too big for the victim who supposedly lived there, but then 10 or 20 people have to be able to fit inside during filming, and the viewers never notice. In fact, the room will be so jammed with actors, technicians, lights, cables, tracks, dollies, and all the rest of it, that it's quite difficult to work out how it will look on the screen. Being the writer on a set is a strange experience. It's hard to describe the sense of excitement walking into something that owes its existence entirely to what happened inside my head. It's true that I'm completely useless, and that no matter where I stand, I'm almost certain to be in the way, but the crew is unfailingly polite and pleasant to me, even if the truth is that we have nothing to say. My work finished weeks ago. Theirs is just beginning. So I'll sit down in a folding chair, which never has my name on the back. I'll watch from the side. I'll chat to the actors. Maybe a runner will bring me a cup of tea in a styrofoam cup. And as I sit there, I'll take comfort in the knowledge that this is all mine. I am part of it, and it is part of me. Mrs. Cooper's living room couldn't have been more different. As I stepped onto the thick piled carpet, with its floral pattern etched out in pink and grey, and took in the crystal chandelier, the comfortable faux antique furniture, the Country Life and Vanity Fair magazines spread out on the coffee table, the books, modern fiction, hardback, nothing by me, on the built-in shelves, I felt like an intruder. I was on my own, wandering through what might as well have been a museum exhibit as a place where someone had recently lived. The police investigators had left those yellow numbers on plastic tags that mark out crime scenes, but there weren't very many of them, suggesting that there hadn't been much to find. A full glass of what looked like water, 12, had been left on an antique sideboard, and next to it I noticed a credit card, 14, with Diana Cooper's name. Were they clues? It was hard to say, just seeing them there. The room had 3 windows, each of them with a pair of velvet curtains hanging all the way to the floor. 5 of the curtains were tied back with knotted red cords and tassels. The curtain nearest the door, 6, was hanging loose, and it reminded me that not so long ago, a middle-aged woman had been strangled right where I was standing. It was all too easy to see her in front of me, her eyes staring, her fists pummeling the air. I looked down and noticed a stain on the carpet, marked by 2 more police numbers. Her bowels had loosened just before she died, the sort of detail I would normally have spared an ITV audience. Hawthorne came into the room, dressed in the same suit as usual, and that's one sentence I definitely don't need to write again. He was eating a sandwich, and it took me a moment to realize that he must have made it for himself in Mrs. Cooper's kitchen, using her food. I stared at him.
"What is it?"
he asked, with his mouth full.
"Nothing," I said.
"Have you had breakfast?"
"I'm fine, thanks."
He must have heard the tone in my voice.
"Shame to waste it," he said. "But she don't need it any more."
He waved the sandwich around the room.
"So what do you think?"
I wasn't sure how to respond. The room was very neat. Apart from the flat-screen television, on a stand rather than mounted on the wall, everything in the room belonged to a former age. Diana Cooper had lived an orderly life, with the magazines placed just so, and the ornaments, glass vases and china figurines, regularly dusted. She had even died tidily. There had been no last-minute struggle, no upturned furniture. The assailant had left just one mark, a muddy half-footprint on the carpet near the door. I could imagine her frowning if she had seen it. She had not been brutally beaten or raped. In many ways, this murder had been sedate.
"She knew the killer," Hawthorne said, "but he wasn't a friend. He was a man, at least 6 feet tall, well-built, with poor eyesight. He came here with the specific intention of killing her, and he wasn't here very long. She left him alone for a while and went into the kitchen. She hoped he was going to leave, but that was when he killed her. After he'd finished, he searched the house and took a few things, but that wasn't the reason he was here. This was personal."
"How can you possibly know all that?" Even as I spoke the words, I was annoyed with myself. I knew it was exactly what he wanted me to ask. I had fallen right into the trap.
"It was getting dark when he arrived," Hawthorne said. "There had been quite a few burglaries in the area. A middle-aged woman, living alone in an expensive part of town, wouldn't open her door to a complete stranger. He was almost certainly a man. I've heard of women strangling women, but take it from me, it's unusual. Diana Cooper was 5'3", and it would have been helpful if he'd been taller than her. He fractured her hyoid bone when he killed her, which tells me he was strong, although I admit she was a bit of an old biddy, so it might have snapped anyway. How do I know he came here to kill her? 3 reasons. He didn't leave any fingerprints. It was a warm evening, but he made sure he was wearing gloves. He didn't stay here very long. He was only in this room, and as you can see, there are no coffee cups, no empty glasses of G&T. If he'd been a friend, 6 o'clock, they'd probably have had a drink together.
He might have been in a hurry, I said.
Look at the cushions, Tony. He didn't even sit down.
I went over to the glass I'd seen and resisted the temptation to pick it up. The police and forensics must have been here, and I was more than a little surprised that they'd left it behind. Wouldn't they have taken it away for immediate analysis? I said as much to Hawthorne.
They've brought it back, he said.
Why?
For me.
He smiled that bleak little smile of his, then finished the rest of the sandwich.
So someone did have a drink, I said. It's only water.
He chewed and swallowed.
My guess is that he asked her for a glass of water before he left. That got her out of the room long enough for him to unhook the curtain and steal the tie. He couldn't have done that with her watching.
But he didn't drink it.
He didn't want to leave his DNA.
What about the credit card? I read the name printed across it. Mrs. Diana J. Cooper. It had been issued by Barclays Bank. Its expiry date was November, 6 months after hers.
That's an interesting one. Why isn't it in her purse with all the others? Did she take it out to pay for something, and is that why she opened the door? There are no fingerprints on it except her own. So you've got a possible scenario. Someone asks her for payment. She takes out the credit card, and while she's fiddling around with it, he slips behind her and strangles her. But then why isn't it on the floor?
He shook his head.
On the other hand, it may have nothing to do with what happened.
We'll see. You said the killer had poor eyesight, I said.
Yes.
That was because he'd missed the diamond ring on her finger. I'd cut in before Hawthorne could explain everything down to the last detail.
Must be worth a fortune.
No, no, mate. You've got that all wrong.
He obviously wasn't interested in the ring. Whoever did this nicked a few pieces of jewellery in a laptop to make it look like a burglary. But he either forgot the ring, or he couldn't get it off her finger and decided not to bother with a pair of secateurs. There's no way he could have missed it. He was right up close when he was strangling her.
Then how do you know his eyesight was bad?
Because he stepped in the puddle outside the door, which is how he left a mark on the carpet. It looks like a man's shoe, by the way. In every other respect, he was careful. That was the one thing he missed.
Aren't you going to write all this down?
I can remember most of it. I took out my iPhone. But I'll take some pictures, if that's okay.
You go ahead. He pointed at a black-and-white photograph of a man in his 40s, also on the sideboard.
Make sure you get a shot of him.
Who's he?
Her husband, I guess. Lawrence Cooper.
Divorced?
He looked at me sadly. If they were divorced, she wouldn't keep his picture, would she? He died 12 years ago. Cancer.
I took the picture. After that, I followed Hawthorne around the house as he went from room to room, photographing everything that he pointed out to me. We started in the kitchen, which had the look of a showroom, expensively stocked but underused. Diana Cooper had enough equipment to cook a Michelin-starred meal for 10, but probably went to bed with a boiled egg and 2 pieces of toast. The fridge was covered with magnets, classical art and famous Shakespearean quotes. A metal tin, merchandise from the Narnia film Prince Caspian, stood on the fridge. Using a cloth to keep his hands from coming into contact with the metal, Hawthorne opened it and looked inside. It was empty, apart from a couple of coins. Everything was in exactly the right place. There were recipe books, Jamie Oliver and Ottolenghi, on the windowsill. Notebooks and recent letters in a rack beside the toaster. A blackboard with notes for the week's shopping. Hawthorne glanced through the letters, then returned them. A wooden fish had been mounted on the wall above the counter, with 5 hooks which Diana used to hang keys, and he seemed particularly interested in these. There were 4 sets, each one of them labelled, and I duly took a picture, noting that according to the tags, they opened the front door, the back door, the cellar, and a second property called Stonor House. "What's this?" I asked. "She used to live there before she moved to London. It's in Walmer, Kent." "A bit odd that she should keep the key." We found a household drawer full of older letters and bills, which Hawthorne glanced through. There was also a brochure for a musical called Moroccan Nights. The front cover showed a picture of a Kalashnikov machine gun with its shoulder strap lying in the shape of a heart. One of the producers listed on the first page was Raymond Clunes. From the kitchen, we went upstairs to the bedroom, passing wallpaper with faint stripes and old theatre programmes in frames. Hamlet, The Tempest, Henry V, The Importance of Being Earnest, The Birthday Party. Damien Cooper had appeared in all of them. Hawthorne bulldozed ahead, but I entered the bedroom with a sense of unease that surprised me. Once again, I felt as if I was intruding. Only a week ago, a middle-aged woman would have undressed here, standing in front of the full-length mirror, sliding into the queen-sized bed with the copy of Stieg Larsson's The Girl Who Played with Fire that was lying on the bedside table. Well, at least Mrs. Cooper had been spared the slightly disappointing ending. There were 2 sets of pillows. I could see the indentation on one of them, made by her head. I could imagine her waking up, warm, perhaps smelling of lavender. Not any more. Death, for me, had always been little more than a necessity, something that moved the plot on. But standing in the bedroom of a woman who had so recently died, I could feel it right there beside me. Hawthorne rifled through the drawers, wardrobes, and bedside cabinets. He glanced briefly at a framed photograph of Damien Cooper, propped up on her makeup table. I vaguely recognised him, although to be honest I'm not good with faces, and most of these young, handsome English actors blend into one another, particularly once they've made the move to Hollywood. He discovered a safe behind Mrs. Cooper's shoe rack, scowled when he found it was still locked, but then forgot it. I was fascinated by the way he searched for clues. He didn't speak to me. He barely noticed I was there. He reminded me a little of a sniffer dog at an airport. There is never any reason to suppose that there will be drugs or bombs in any of the suitcases, but the dog will examine every one of them and will be sure to find anything that's there. Hawthorne had the same vagueness, the same certainty. From the bedroom, he moved into the bathroom. There were about 20 little bottles gathered around the bath. She'd had the habit of taking the shampoo and bath gel from hotels. He opened a cabinet above the basin and took out 3 packets of temazepam, sleeping pills. He showed them to me. "Interesting," he said. It was the first word he had spoken for a while. "She was worried about something," I said. "She couldn't sleep." I followed Hawthorne as he continued around the house. There were 2 guest rooms on the upper floor, but they clearly hadn't been used for a while. They were almost too clean, with a chill in the air, the central heating turned down to save on bills. He took a brief look around, then went back out into the corridor. "What do you think happened to the cat?" he muttered. "What cat?" I asked. "The old lady's cat. Persian grey. One of those horrible bloody things that looked like a medicine ball with fur." "I didn't see a photograph of a cat." "Nor did I." He didn't add anything, and I was suddenly irritated. "If I'm going to write about you, you're going to have to tell me how you work. It's all very well making these pronouncements, but you can't just leave them hanging in the air." He frowned as if he was trying to make sense of what I had just said, then nodded. "It's pretty bloody obvious, Tony. There was a feeding bowl down in the kitchen. And the pillow, didn't you notice?" "The indentation? I thought that was her head." "I doubt it, mate. Not unless she had short, silky hair and smelled of fish. She slept on the left side of the bed. That was where the book was. The cat slept with her on the other side. It was obviously heavy, quite big. I'd guess a Persian grey. It's just the sort of pet a woman like her would have. But it's not here. Maybe the police took it." "Maybe they did." We went back downstairs, and as we re-entered the living room, I saw that we were no longer alone. A man in a cheap suit was sitting on the sofa with his legs apart and a file spread out across his lap. His tie was crooked, and 2 of the buttons on his shirt were undone. I had a feeling he was a smoker. Everything about him was unhealthy. The colour of his skin, his thinning hair, broken nose, stomach pressing against the waistband of his trousers. He was about the same age as Hawthorne, but bigger, flabbier. He could have retired from the boxing ring, but I guessed he must be a police officer. I'd seen his sort often enough on television. Not in dramas, but on the news, standing outside courtrooms, awkwardly reading a prepared statement to the camera. "Hawthorne," he said, without any enthusiasm. "Detective Inspector Meadows." Hawthorne had used a formal title, ironically, as if it somehow wasn't deserved. "Hello, Jack," he added. "I couldn't believe it when they told me they'd brought you in on this one. Seems straightforward enough to me." He noticed me for the first time. "Who are you?" I wasn't quite sure how to introduce myself. "He's a writer," Hawthorne said, stepping in. "He's with me." "What? Writing about you?" "Writing about the case." "I hope you've got that authorised." He paused. "I left everything for you, like I was told. Brought stuff back, laid it all out just like we found it. Complete waste of time, if you ask me." "I don't, Jack. No one ever does." He took that on the chin. "You had a chance to look round then? Have you finished?" "I was just leaving." But Hawthorne stayed where he was. "You say it's straightforward. So what are your thoughts?" "I'm not going to share my thoughts with you if you don't mind." He got lazily to his feet. He was a bigger man than I had thought. He towered over both of us. He had gathered up the pages and, almost as an afterthought, he handed them over. "They told me to give you these." The file contained photographs, forensic reports, witness statements, and records of all the telephone calls made to and from both the house and Diana Cooper's mobile phone in the past 2 weeks. Hawthorne glanced at the top page. "She sent a text message at 6:31. "That's right, just before she was strangled. My killer was ah!" He smiled at his own joke. "I've read the text. It doesn't make a lot of sense, so I'll leave you to work it out." He went over to the glass of water that I'd noticed on the sideboard next to the credit card. "I'll take this now, if you don't mind. Be my guest." For the first time, I noticed that Meadows was wearing gloves. He had some sort of plastic cap which he used to seal the glass, then lifted it to take it with him. "The only fingerprints on it are hers," Hawthorne said, "and there's no DNA. Nobody drank out of it." "You've seen the report?" Meadows seemed puzzled. "No need to see anything, mate. Bloody obvious." He smiled. "You look at that tin in the kitchen, Prince Caspian. Few coins, no fingerprints, nothing." "No surprise there, either." Hawthorne glanced at the sideboard. "How about the credit card?" "What about it?" "When was it last used?" "You'll find all her financial details in there." Meadows nodded at the file. $15,000 in her private account, another $200,000 savings. She's doing all right." He remembered what Hawthorne had asked. "The last time she used the card was a week ago, Harrods. That's where she bought her groceries. Smoked salmon and cream cheese." "How did you know that?" "It was in the kitchen. I had it for breakfast." "That's evidence." "Not anymore." Meadows scowled. "Anything else you want to know?" "Yes. Did you find the cat?" "What cat?" "That answers the question." "Then I'll leave you to it." Meadows was holding the glass as if he were a magician about to make a goldfish appear. He nodded at me. "Nice to meet you," he said. "But I'd watch out for yourself when you're around this one, particularly if you go near any stairs." He was pleased with that. He took one last look around the room, and then, still holding the glass in front of him, he left. 5. The Lacerated Man. What did he mean, that crack about the stairs? "Charlie Meadows is a pillock. He didn't mean anything." "Charlie? You called him Jack." "Everyone does." We were sitting outside a cafe close to Fulham Broadway Station. Fortunately, the sun was shining. so Hawthorne could smoke. He had gone through the documents that Meadows had given him, sharing them with me, too. There were photographs of Diana Cooper before and after she had died, and I was shocked by the difference. The corpse that Andrea Kluvanek had discovered bore almost no resemblance to the smart, active socialite who had invested in theatre and eaten lunch in expensive restaurants in Mayfair. "I come in at 11 o'clock. Is the start of my work time. I see her and I know at once that something very bad has happened." Andrea's statement was attached, reproduced word for word, in her broken English. There was a photograph of her, a slim, round-faced woman, quite boyish, with short, spiky hair, staring defensively at the camera. Hawthorne had told me she had a criminal record, but I found it difficult to imagine her murdering Diana Cooper. She was too small. There was plenty of other material, too. In fact, it occurred to me that it might be possible for Hawthorne to solve the murder right here at this table over his coffee and cigarette. I hoped not. If that happened, it would be a very short book. Perhaps it was with that thought in mind that I wanted to talk about other things first. "How do you know him?" I asked.
"Who?"
"Meadows."
"We worked in the same subcommand in Putney. He had the office next to mine, and although I always held my nose, there were a few times I had to walk down the dark side."
"I don't know what that means."
"It's when you have to ask another team for help. When we were doing house to house, that sort of thing."
Hawthorne seemed anxious to move on. "Do you want to talk about Diana Cooper?"
"No," I said. "I want to talk about you."
He gazed at the paperwork spread out on the table. He didn't need to say anything. This was all that mattered to him. But for once, I was on my home ground, and I was determined. "The only way this is going to work is if you allow me into your life," I said. "I've got to know about you."
"Nobody's interested in me."
"If that were true, I wouldn't be here.
If it's true, the book won't sell."
I watched as Hawthorne lit another cigarette. For the first time in 30 years, I was tempted to ask for one myself. "Listen to me," I went on, carefully. "They're not called murder victim stories. They're not called criminal stories. They're called detective stories. There's a reason for that. I'm taking a big risk here. If you solve this crime right now, I won't have anything to write about. Worse than that, if you don't solve it at all, it'll be a complete waste of time. So, getting to know you matters. If I know you, if I can find something that makes you more human, at least that's a start. So you can't just brush aside every question I ask you. You can't hide behind this wall." Hawthorne shrank away. It was funny how, with his pale skin and those troubled, almost childlike eyes, he could make himself seem vulnerable.
"I don't want to talk about Jack Meadows. He didn't like me. And when the shit hit the fan, he was happy to see me go."
"What shit? What fan?"
"When I left."
That was all he was going to say, so I made a mental note to follow it up later. Obviously now wasn't the right time. I opened the notebook, which I had brought with me, and took out a pen. "All right. While we're sitting here, I want to ask you a few questions about yourself. I don't even know where you live." He hesitated. This really was going to be blood out of a stone.
"I've got a place in Gants Hill," he said at length.
I'd often driven through Gants Hill, a suburb in northeast London, on the way to Suffolk.
"Are you married?"
"Yes." I could see that there was more to come, but it took a while to arrive.
"We're not together anymore."
"Don't ask me about that."
"Do you support a football team?"
"Arsenal." He said it without much enthusiasm, and I suspected that if he was a football fan, he was a fairly casual one.
"Do you go to the cinema?"
"Sometimes." He was getting impatient. "What about music?"
"What about it?"
"Classical? Jazz?"
"I don't listen to music much."
I'd been thinking of Morse and his love of opera, but that had just gone out of the window too. "Do you have children?" He swiped the cigarette out of his lips, holding it like a poisoned dart, and I saw that I'd pushed too hard, too soon.
"This isn't going to work,"
he snapped. And at that moment, I could easily imagine him in a police station, in an interrogation room. He was looking at me with something close to contempt. "You can write what you like about me.
You can make it all up if you want to. What difference does it make? But I'm not going to play fucking university challenge with you now or at any time. I've got a dead woman and somebody strangled her in her own front room, and that's all that matters to me right at this moment. He snatched up one of the pages. Do you want to look at this or not? I could have gone home right then. I could have forgotten the whole thing, and given what happened later on, it might have been better if I had. But I had just left the murder scene. It was almost as if I knew Diana Cooper, and for some reason, maybe it was the photographs I had seen, the violence of her death, I felt I owed her something. I wanted to know more. All right, I said. I put down my pen. Show me. The page contained a screenshot of the text that Diana Cooper had sent to her son just before she died. I have seen the boy who was lacerated, and I'm afraid.
What do you make of that? He asked.
She was interrupted before she finished, I said. There's no full stop. She didn't have time to say what she was afraid of.
Well, maybe she was just afraid. Maybe she was too afraid to worry about the full stop at the end of the sentence.
Meadows was right, it doesn't make any sense.
Then maybe this will help.
Hawthorne pulled out three more pages, copies of newspaper articles written 10 years before. Daily Mail, Friday, 8th of June, 2001. Twin boy killed in hit-and-run horror. His brother is in critical condition, but doctors say he will recover. An 8-year-old boy was fighting for his life and his twin brother was killed by a short-sighted motorist who ploughed into both children before driving off. Jeremy Godwin was left with injuries which include a fractured skull and a severe laceration of the brain. His brother, Timothy, died instantly. The accident took place at 4:30 on Thursday afternoon on the Marine in the coastal resort of Deal, Kent. The two boys, who have been described as inseparable, were returning to their hotel with their nanny, 25-year-old Mary O'Brien. She told the police, the car came round the corner, the driver didn't even try to slow down. She hit the children and drove straight off. I've been with the family for 3 years, and I'm devastated. I couldn't believe she didn't stop. Police have arrested a 52-year-old woman. The Telegraph, Saturday, 9th of June, 2001. Police arrest short-sighted driver who killed twin. The woman who killed 8-year-old twin Timothy Godwin and inflicted life-threatening injuries on his brother has been named as Diana Cooper. Mrs. Cooper, 52, is a long-term resident of Walmer, Kent, and was returning from the Royal Cinque Ports Golf Club when the accident took place. Mrs. Cooper, who had been drinking at the clubhouse with friends, was not over the limit, and witnesses have confirmed that she was not speeding. However, she was driving without her spectacles, and in a test conducted by the police, she was unable to read a registration plate 25 feet away. Her lawyers have made the following statement. Our client had spent the afternoon playing golf and was on her way home when the incident took place. She had unfortunately mislaid her glasses, but thought she would be able to drive the relatively short distance without them. She admits that she panicked following the accident and drove straight home. However, she was fully aware of the seriousness of what she had done and contacted the police within 2 hours that same evening. Police have charged Mrs. Cooper under Sections 1 and 170, 2 and 4 of the Road Traffic Act of 1988. She faces charges of causing death by dangerous driving and failing to stop at the scene of an accident. Mrs. Cooper gave her address as Liverpool Road, Walmer. She had recently lost her husband after a long illness. Her 23-year-old son, Damien Cooper, is an actor who has performed with the Royal Shakespeare Company and who was last seen in the birthday party on the West End stage. The Times, Tuesday, 6th of November, 2001. Family calls for change in law as hit-and-run driver walks free. The mother of an 8-year-old boy killed as he was crossing the road in the seaside town of Deal, Kent, spoke out today as the driver walked free. Timothy Godwin died instantly, and his twin brother, Jeremy, received severe lacerations to the brain after Diana Cooper, 52, failed to see them. It turned out that Mrs. Cooper had left her spectacles at the golf club where she had been playing and was unable to see beyond 20 feet. Canterbury Crown Court had heard that she had not broken the law by not wearing her glasses. Judge Nigel Weston, QC, said, "It was not a wise idea to drive without your spectacles, but they were not a legal requirement as the law stands, and there can be no doubting your remorse. In the light of this, I've decided that a custodial sentence would not be appropriate." Mrs. Cooper was disqualified from driving for a year, had 9 penalty points added to her licence and was ordered to pay £900 costs. The judge also suggested 3 months of restorative justice, but the family of the two boys have refused to meet her. Speaking outside the court, Judith Godwin said, "Nobody should be allowed to get behind the wheel of a car if they can't see. If that's not against the law, then the law should be changed. My son is dead, my other son has been crippled, and she just gets a slap on the wrist. That can't be right." A spokesperson for Brake, the road safety charity, said, "Nobody should drive if they are not fully in control of their car." I looked at the dates above the three articles and made the connection. "This all happened exactly 10 years ago," I exclaimed.
9 years and 11 months, Hawthorne corrected me. "The accident was at the start of June."
"It's still pretty much the anniversary." I handed back the third article. "And the boy who survived, he had brain lacerations." I picked up Diana Cooper's text. "The boy who was lacerated."
"You think there's a connection?"
I assumed he was being sarcastic, but I didn't rise to the bait.
"Do you know where she lives?" I asked.
"Judith Godwin."
Hawthorne searched through the other pages. "There's an address in Harrow on the Hill."
"Not Kent?"
"They might have been on holiday. The first week in June, that summer after."
So perhaps Hawthorne had children after all. How else would he have known? But I didn't dare raise that subject again. Instead, I asked, "Are we going to see her?"
"No need to hurry. And we've got a meeting with Mr. Cornwallis just down the road."
My mind had gone blank for a moment. I had no idea who he was referring to.
"The undertaker," he reminded me.
He began to gather up the documents, drawing them towards him like a croupier with a pack of cards. It was interesting that as much as Detective Inspector Meadows had disliked him, someone higher up in the Met was taking him seriously. The crime scene had been left untouched for his examination. He was being kept fully in the loop. Hawthorne stubbed out his cigarette.
"Let's go," he said.
Once again, I noticed, I'd paid for the coffees. We took the number 14 back down the Fulham Road, the same bus used by Diana Cooper on the day she died. We exited, as Hawthorne would have put it, at 12:26 and retraced our steps to the funeral parlour. I hadn't been to a funeral parlour since my father died, and that was a long time ago. I'd been 21 years old. Although he had suffered a protracted illness, the end had come very suddenly, and the whole family was poleaxed. For reasons that still aren't clear to me, an uncle stepped in and took control of the burial arrangements. After years of agnosticism, my father had expressed a desire to have an orthodox funeral. I'm sure my uncle thought he was doing us a favour, but unfortunately, he was a loud, opinionated man, and I can't say I'd ever been very fond of him. Even so, I found myself accompanying him to a funeral parlour in North London. In Jewish families, the burial happens very quickly, and I hadn't yet had time to accept what was happening. I was still in shock. I have vague memories of a large room that was more like a lost property office in a railway station than an undertaker's. Everything was very dark, in different shades of brown. There was a short, bearded man standing behind a counter, wearing an ill-fitting suit and a yarmulke. The funeral director, or perhaps one of his assistants. As if in a nightmare, I see a crowd of people surrounding me. Were they other customers or staff? I seem to remember that there was no privacy. My uncle was negotiating the price of the funeral, which was to take place the following day. He didn't ask me what I thought. He was discussing the various coffins and different options with the counterman, and as I stood there listening to them, their voices became more and more heated until I realized that the two of them were actually engaged in a full-blooded argument. My uncle accused the funeral director of cheating us, and that was what finally did it. The other man exploded in rage. He'd gone quite red in the face, and now he was jabbing a finger at us, shouting, with saliva flecking at his lips.
"You want mahogany? You pay for mahogany!"
I've no idea whether my father was buried in mahogany or plywood, and frankly I don't care. The fury of the undertaker and the words he spoke have echoed in my memory for almost 40 years. They have made me determined that my own funeral will be short, cheap, and non-denominational. And they were still with me as I followed Hawthorne into Cornwallis and Sons, closing the door, silently, behind me. The funeral parlour was very much as I've described it, smaller and less threatening than the office I remembered from my past. But this time, of course, there was no personal connection for me. Hawthorne introduced himself to Irene Laws, who took us directly to Robert Cornwallis's office at the end of the corridor, the same room where Diana Cooper had made the arrangements that she would now be requiring. This time Irene stayed, planting herself firmly in a chair, as if Diana Cooper's untimely death had been her fault, and she expected to be interrogated along with her cousin. Again, I found myself wondering what it must be like to work there, sitting in a room with those miniature urns, a constant reminder that everything you were and everything you'd achieved would one day fit inside. Hawthorne hadn't introduced me, by the way. He never did. They must have assumed I was his assistant. "I have already spoken to the police," Cornwallis began. "Yes, sir." It was interesting that Hawthorne called him sir. I saw at once that it was quite different when he was dealing with witnesses or suspects, or anyone who might help him with his investigation. He came across as ordinary, even obsequious. The more I got to know him, the more I saw that he did this quite deliberately. People lowered their guard when they were talking to him. They had no idea what sort of man he was, that he was only waiting for the right moment to dissect them. For him, politeness was a surgical mask, something he slipped on before he took out his scalpel. "Because of the unusual nature of the crime, I've been asked to provide independent support to the investigation. I'm very sorry to take up your time." He gave the funeral director a crocodile smile. "Do you mind if I smoke?" "Well, actually..." It was too late. The cigarette was already between his lips, the lighter sparking. Mrs. Laws frowned and slid a pewter saucer onto the desk for him to use as an ashtray. I noticed an engraving around the side. "Awarded to Robert Daniel Cornwallis, Undertaker of the Year, 2008. "Would you mind going over your meeting with Mrs. Cooper once again, starting from the beginning?" Robert Cornwallis did exactly that, speaking in the same measured tone that he must have used many times in his years spent dealing with the bereaved. Hawthorne may have criticised some of the embellishments which I added in my first chapter, but what he told us corresponded more or less exactly to what I had written. Mrs. Cooper had been reasonable, businesslike, and precise. She had arrived without an appointment, and she had left once everything had been agreed. In retrospect, I may have been a little unfair to Robert Cornwallis. I described him as crumpled and mournful, but it may be that I was confusing the man with his profession, and this time I was struck by how very ordinary he was. Take away the corpses, the embalming fluids, the interments and the tears, and I'm sure he'd be perfectly pleasant. Someone you'd be happy to chat to if you met him at a party. It would just be better not to ask him what he did. "How long was Mrs. Cooper with you?" Hawthorne asked. It was as if Irene Laws had been waiting for the question.
"She was here for just over 50 minutes, she replied with a clipped exactitude of a speaking clock.
"I was going to say an hour," Cornwallis agreed. "We went over all the arrangements very carefully, and the prices." "How much was she going to pay you?"
"Irene can provide you with a complete breakdown. She already had a plot in Brompton Cemetery, which saved a considerable amount of money. The price of a resting place in London has increased greatly over the years, in the same way as property. The final figure, including the Church of England burial fee and the grave digger, was £3,000.
£3,170, Miss Laws corrected him.
"Did she pay with a credit card?"
"Yes. She paid in full, although I assured her that there was a 10-day cooling-off period should she have second thoughts. In that respect, we're rather similar to double glazing salesmen."
This was his little joke. He smiled. Irene Laws frowned.
"What do you do with that money?" I asked. "I mean, if she hadn't died."
"We would have placed it in escrow. We belong to a trust known as the Golden Charter, which takes care of payments, and also, of course, calculates for inflation. Somewhere in the back of my mind, it had occurred to me that the funeral parlour might have welcomed Mrs. Cooper's death, because they would be the first to profit from it, providing the funeral. But if she had already paid, the very reverse was true. I was glad I hadn't mentioned it. Even so, Hawthorne threw an angry glance at me, letting me know that my contribution had annoyed him.
"What sort of mood would you say she was in?" he asked, changing the subject completely.
"The same mood as anyone who comes here," Cornwallis replied. "She was a little uncomfortable, at least to begin with. We have a great reticence talking about death in this country. I always say it's a shame we don't adopt the practice of the Swiss, who invented what they call the café mortel, an opportunity to discuss one's mortality over tea and cake.
I wouldn't say no to a cup of tea if you've got one, Hawthorne said.
Cornwallis glanced at Miss Laws, who got up and stomped out of the room.
You say she'd already worked out everything she wanted for the funeral?
Yes, she'd written it down.
Do you still have that document?
No, she took it with her. I made a copy, which I included in the summary that I sent her.
Will you say there was any urgency on her part? Did she tell you why she'd chosen that particular day to come in?
She didn't appear to consider herself to be in danger, if that's what you mean. Cornwallis shook his head.
It's not unusual for people to plan their funerals, Mr. Hawthorne. She wasn't ill, she wasn't nervous or afraid. I already said this to the police. I also told them that both I and Miss Laws were shocked when we heard the news.
Why did you telephone her?
I'm sorry?
I have her phone records. You telephoned her at 2:05. She'd just arrived for a board meeting at the Globe Theatre. You spoke to her for about a minute and a half.
You're quite right. I needed the plot number of her husband's grave. Cornwallis smiled. I had to contact the Royal Parks Chapel office to register the interment. It was the one piece of information she hadn't given me. There's something I should perhaps mention. She was having some sort of argument when I spoke to her. I heard voices in the background. She said she'd called back, but of course she never did. Irene Laws returned with Hawthorne's tea. The cup rattled against the saucer as she set it down.
Is there anything else I can help you with, Mr. Hawthorne?
Cornwallis asked.
I'd be interested to know, did you both speak to her?
Irene showed her into this office.
I spoke to her briefly in the reception area, but I didn't stay for the meeting,
Miss Laws interrupted as she took her place.
Was she ever on her own?
Cornwallis frowned.
What a very odd question. Why do you want to know?
I'm just interested.
No, I was with her the whole time.
Just before she left, she used the cloakroom, Miss Laws said.
You mean the toilet?
That's what I said. That was the only time she was on her own. I took her to the room, which is just along the corridor, and then came back with her while she collected her things. I'd also like to say that she was in a perfectly pleasant state of mind when she left. If anything, she was relieved. But that's often the way when people come here. In fact, it's part of our service.
Hawthorne downed his tea in three large gulps. We stood up to leave. Then one thought occurred to me.
She didn't say anything about someone called Timothy Godwin, did she? I asked.
Timothy Godwin? Cornwallis shook his head. Who is he?
He was a boy she accidentally killed in a car accident, I said. He had a brother, Jeremy Godwin.
What a terrible thing to happen. Cornwallis turned to his cousin.
Did she mention either of those names to you, Irene?
No.
I doubt they're relevant.
Hawthorne had cut off the discussion before it could go any further. He stretched out a hand.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Cornwallis.
Outside, in the street, he turned on me.
Do me a favour, mate. Never ask questions when you're with me. Never ask anything, all right?
You just expect me to sit there and say nothing.
That's right.
I'm not stupid, I said. I may be able to help.
Well, you're wrong on at least one of those counts. But the point is, you're not here to help. You've said this was a detective story. I'm the detective. It's as simple as that.
Then tell me what you've learned, I said. You've been to the crime scene, you've seen the phone records, you've talked to the undertaker. Do you know anything yet?
Hawthorne considered what I'd said. He had a blank look in his eyes, and for a moment I thought he was going to dismiss me out of hand. Then he took pity on me. Diana Cooper knew she was going to die, he said. I waited for him to add something more, but he simply turned and stormed off down the pavement. I considered my options, then followed, in every sense, struggling to catch up. 6. Witness Statements. I didn't know very much about Diana Cooper, but it was already clear to me that there couldn't have been whole crowds of people queuing up to murder her. She was a middle-aged woman, a widow, living on her own. She was well off, without being super rich, on the board of a theatre, and the mother of a famous son. She had difficulty sleeping, and she had a cat. True, she'd lost money to a theatrical producer, and she'd employed a cleaner with a criminal record, but what reason would either of them have had to strangle her?
The one thing that stood out was the fact that she had killed a little boy and badly injured his brother. The accident had been caused by her own carelessness. She hadn't been wearing her spectacles, and worse still, she had driven away without stopping. Despite all this, she had walked free. If I had been Timothy and Jeremy Godwin's father, if I had been related to them in any way, I might have been tempted to kill her myself. And all of this had happened exactly 10 years ago. Well, 9 years and 11 months. Close enough. It was an obvious motive for murder. If the Godwin family was living in North London, in Harrow-on-the-Hill, I couldn't understand why we weren't heading there straight away, and I said as much to Hawthorne.
"One step at a time," he replied. "There are other people I want to talk to first."
"The cleaner?" We were actually sitting in a taxi that was taking us around Shepherd's Bush roundabout on our way to Acton, which was where Andrea Kluvanek lived. Hawthorne had also telephoned Raymond Clunes, and we were seeing him later.
"You don't suspect her, do you?"
"I suspect her of lying to the police, yes."
"And Clunes? What's he got to do with this?"
"He knew Mrs. Cooper. 78% of female victims are killed by someone they know." He went on before I could interrupt.
"Really?
I thought you'd have known that, you being a TV writer." Ignoring the no-smoking sign, he pressed the button to lower the window of the cab and lit a cigarette. "Husband, stepfather, lover. Speaking statistically, they're the most likely killers."
"Raymond Clunes wasn't any of those things."
"He could have been her lover."
"She saw the boy with the lacerations, Jeremy Godwin. She said she was afraid. I don't know why you're wasting your time."
"There's no smoking," the driver complained over the intercom. "Fuck off, I'm a police officer," Hawthorne replied equanimously. "What were those words you used? Modus operandi. This is mine." He blew smoke out of the window, but the wind just whipped it back into the cab. "Start with the people who were closest to her, and work outwards from there. It's like doing a house-to-house. You start with the neighbours. You don't start at the end of the street." He turned his eyes on me, once again interrogating. "You got a problem with that?"
"It just seems a bit crazy to be herring around London. And at my expense," I added quietly.
Hawthorne said nothing more. After what seemed like a very long drive, the taxi pulled up on the edge of the South Acton estate, a sprawling collection of slab blocks and high-rise towers that had sprung up over the decades starting at the end of the war. There was some landscaping, lawns, trees, and pedestrian walkways, but the overall effect was dispiriting, if only because there were so many homes packed together. We walked beside a skateboard park that looked as if it hadn't been used for years, and then down into an underpass, the walls covered with crude graffiti images, bleeding garishly into one another. No Banksies here. A huddle of 20-somethings in hoodies and sweatshirts were sitting in the shadows, watching us with sullen, suspicious eyes. Fortunately, Hawthorne seemed to know where he was going, and I stayed close to him, thinking back to what the woman at Hale and Wye had said to me. Perhaps this was the dose of reality she had prescribed. Andrea Kluvanek lived on the second floor of one of the towers. Hawthorne had telephoned ahead, and she was expecting us. I knew from the police files that she had 2 children, but it was 1:30 in the afternoon, and I guess they were both at school. Her flat was clean, but it was very small, with no more furniture than was needed. 3 chairs at the kitchen table, a single sofa in front of the TV. Even the most optimistic estate agent wouldn't have called the living room open plan. The kitchen simply blended into it, with no way of saying where one ended and the other began. This was a 1-bedroom flat, and I have no idea how they managed at night. Maybe the children had the bedroom, and she slept on the sofa. We sat down, facing her across the table. There were pots and pans hanging on hooks, inches behind our heads. Andrea did not offer us tea or coffee. She gazed at us suspiciously across the formica surface of her kitchen table, a small, dark woman who looked even tougher in real life than she had in the photograph I had seen. She was wearing a T-shirt and jeans that had been torn in a way that wasn't a fashion statement. Hawthorne had lit a cigarette, and she had taken one off him too, so I was sitting there surrounded by smoke, wondering if I would actually manage to finish the book before I died of some secondary smoking-related disease. To begin with, Hawthorne was quite pleasant with her. His tone was conversational, as he took her through the statement she had given to the police, and which I have already described. She had come into the house, seen the dead woman, gone straight outside, and called the police. She had waited until they arrived.
"You must have got very wet," Hawthorne said.
"What?" She looked at him suspiciously.
"It was raining that morning when you discovered the body. If I'd been you, I'd have waited in the kitchen. Nice and warm, there's a phone in there too. No need to use your mobile."
"I go outside. I already say all this. The police ask me what happened, and I tell them."
Her English wasn't very good, and it got worse the angrier she became.
"I know, Andrea," Hawthorne said. "I read what you told the police, but I've come all the way across London to talk to you face to face, because I want you to tell me the truth."
There was a long silence. "I speak the truth." She didn't sound convincing.
"No, you don't."
Hawthorne sighed gently, as if this wasn't something he really wanted to do.
"How long have you been in this country?"
he asked.
At once she was defensive.
5 years.
2 years with Diana Cooper.
Yes.
How many days a week did you work for her?
2 days, Wednesday and Friday.
Did you ever tell her about that little trouble you had?
I have no trouble.
Hawthorne shook his head sadly. You have a lot of trouble. In Huddersfield, that's where you were living. Shoplifting. 150 quid fine, plus costs.
You'll not understand.
Andrea glowered at him. I was wishing the room was bigger. I felt out of place and uncomfortable being so close to her.
I have nothing to eat, no husband. My children, 4-year-old, 6-year-old, have nothing to eat.
So you nick stuff from a charity shop? Well, it was Save the Children. I suppose you were taking it literally.
It's not.
And it was a second offence, Hawthorne went on before she could deny it. You were already on a conditional discharge. I'd say you were lucky the judge was in a good mood.
Andrea was still defiant. I work for Mrs. Cooper for 2 years. She look after me, so I no need to steal nothing. I am honest person. I look after my family.
Well, you won't be able to look after your family when you're in jail.
Hawthorne allowed this to sink in.
You lie to me, and that's where you'll end up. Your children will be in care, or maybe they'll be sent back to Slovakia. I want to know how much money you took.
What money?
The housekeeping money that your employer kept in a Prince Caspian tin. You know who Prince Caspian is? He's a character in Narnia. Her son, Damien Cooper, was in the film. She kept the tin in the kitchen. I looked in it, and I found a couple of coins.
That's where she keep money, yes, but I don't take it. The thief take it.
No.
Hawthorne was angry. His eyes had darkened, and the hand holding his cigarette had curled into a fist.
A thief went through the house, it's true. He poked around a bit here and there. It was like he wanted us to know where he'd been. But this was different. The tin was put back in its right place. The lid was screwed back on. It was wiped clean of fingerprints by someone who'd been watching too many crime shows on TV. I don't think you get it. There had to be some fingerprints on the surface. Yours, your boss's. My guess is you pulled out a wadge of notes and didn't notice the coins. How much was there?
Andrea stared at him sullenly.
I wondered how much she had understood.
I take money, she said at last.
How much?
£50.
Hawthorne looked pained. How much?
160.
He nodded. That's better. And you didn't wait outside either. Why would you when it was pissing down? What I want to know is, what else did you do? What else did you take?
I saw Andrea struggling with the decision that she had to make. Did she admit to further wrongdoing and possibly get herself into more trouble? Or did she try to deceive Hawthorne and risk angering him again? In the end, she bowed to her better sense. She got up and took a folded piece of paper out of a kitchen drawer. She handed it to him. He unfolded it and read, "Mrs. Cooper, you think you can just get rid of me, but I will not leave you alone. What I said is just the beginning, I promise you. I have been watching you, and I know the things that are dear to you.
You are going to pay. Believe me. It was a handwritten letter, unsigned, with no date or address. Hawthorne looked from it to Andrea, inquiry in his eyes.
A man come to the house, she explained, 3 week ago. He go with Mrs. Cooper in the living room. I was upstairs in the bedroom, but I hear them talking. He was very angry, shouting at her.
What time is this?
It was Wednesday, about 1 o'clock.
Did you see him?
I look out of the window when he leave, but it was raining and he have umbrella. I see nothing.
You're sure it was a man?
Andrea considered. I think so, yes.
And what about this? Hawthorne held up the sheet of paper.
Is in her bedroom table.
Andrea actually managed to look ashamed, although I think she was just afraid of what Hawthorne might do to her.
I take a look in the house after she die, and I find it. She paused. I think this man kill Mr. Tibbs.
Who's Mr. Tibbs?
Mrs. Cooper have a cat, is a big grey cat.
She held out her hands, showing us its size.
She called me on Thursday, she tell me not to come in. She very upset, and she say that Mr. Tibbs has gone.
Why did you take the letter? I asked. Andrea looked at Hawthorne, as if asking his permission to ignore me. Hawthorne nodded. He folded the letter back up and slipped it into his pocket. The two of us left.
She took the letter because she thought she could make money out of it, Hawthorne said. Maybe she knows the man who visited Diana Cooper, the man with the umbrella. Or maybe she thought she could find him. But she's an opportunist. She knew there was going to be a murder investigation. This was something she thought she could use.
We were sitting together in another taxi on our way back into town. We had one meeting left with Raymond Clunes, the theatre producer who'd had lunch with Diana Cooper on the day she died. I was even more convinced now that this was a waste of time. Surely Hawthorne had the identity of the killer in his pocket. You are going to pay. What could have been clearer than that? But he said nothing more about the interview with Andrea Kluvanek. He was deep in thought. In fact, it was more than that. He was totally absorbed. This is something I would learn about Hawthorne. He was someone who was only fully alive when he was working on a case. He needed there to have been a murder or some other violent crime. It was his entire raison d'etre, another posh phrase which I'm sure he would have hated. Clunes lived in rather different circumstances to Andrea Kluvanek. His home was behind Marble Arch, close to Connaught Square, and I wasn't at all surprised that this was the home of a theatre producer. The building itself was like a stage set, made of red brick and almost improbably two-dimensional, with an imposing front door and brightly painted windows set in perfect symmetry. Everything was pristine, even the dustbins standing in a neat line on the other side of the metal railings. A flight of steps led down to a basement with its own separate entrance. There were 4 more floors rising above. I guessed I was looking at around 5 bedrooms and at least £30 million worth of central London property. Hawthorne wasn't impressed. He jabbed at the doorbell as if he had some personal animosity against it. There was nobody else in the street, and I got the feeling that most of the houses here would be empty, owned by foreign businessmen. Didn't Tony Blair live somewhere close by? As central as it was, I'd never actually been to this particular area. It didn't feel like London at all. The door was opened by that standby of every whodunit, something I had never expected to encounter in the 21st century. Clunes had a butler, the real thing, in pinstriped suit, waistcoat and gloves. He was a man of about my age, with swept-back dark hair and a look of dignity that he must have nailed into place each day.
"Good afternoon, sir. Please come in."
He didn't need to ask our names. We were expected. We went into a large hallway between 2 reception rooms, the floors fabulously carpeted, the ceilings triple height. It didn't look at all like someone's home. It was more like a hotel, though one without paying guests. As we climbed the stairs, I noticed a Hockney pool painting with a boy just disappearing beneath the surface, followed by a Francis Bacon triptych. We reached a landing with a huge Robert Mapplethorpe nude, although it showed only a part of the subject's anatomy. It was a black and white photograph, the background white, the buttocks and erect penis black.
Just to one side stood a classical sculpture of a naked shepherd boy. Hawthorne looked uncomfortable as we walked past this blatant